Hello there again, and welcome to Musings on Golf, where we're going to hear from one of the great all-around guys in the game and a World Golf Hall of Fame member in Nick Price. I'm Kelly Elbin, along with Bob Bupka. You know, Bob, we talk so much about the gentleman that Nick Price was on his years on tour and continues to be today. But man, could he play. And Bob, what a run he had.
Yeah, it's actually unbelievable when you look back at it. How good was Nick Price? Between 1992 and 1994, Nick Price won 16 of 54 worldwide tournaments that he played in. And you're right about Nick being a nice guy. He was even nicer as a person. What a class act. What a wonderful, wonderful ambassador for the game of golf. I mean, Nick, he was a class act from the minute he got onto the golf course to signing his scorecard to doing the media request and then doing autographs. Nick, first class in my book.
So many times I watched him play, and yes, I agree with you from the class that he exuded. But you have to have that competitive side to you, Bob. You have to have that, as he talked a lot about, just kind of shutting everything out. But I've always thought that in Nick Price there was a quiet, ferocious competitor who just wouldn't be denied when he was on top of his game. I think that's the way he played. I think he was great golf swing, what was sort of been called like a staccato type swing, and it's unique almost if you watch him. But there was always something burning inside him that allowed him to win.
Yeah, on the outside you saw a nice smile from Nick. Inside you found a fierce competitor that loved winning and worked hard at it, practiced hard, gives a lot of credit to David Ledbetter for aiding him when his swing would go south. What a team. Ledbetter and Price actually grew up in the same country in South Africa. So they were, you know, they were buddies a long time. And if you ask David Ledbetter, and we hope to get him on in the future, David probably will say best pupil he ever had in Nick Price.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised that he would say that at all. Some great stories coming up. Hope you all enjoy hearing from Nick Price, and you're going to hear from him right after this from Titleist.
The all-new Pro V1 and Pro V1X are designed to outperform. Created in Titleist R&D laboratories, manufactured in Titleist golf ball plants, and then validated by the best players in the world. These golf balls are longer and more consistent with unrivaled control. Outperform with the new Titleist Pro V1 and Pro V1X.
Welcome back to Musings on Golf. Bob, it's always an honor and a thrill to be joined by a member of the World Golf Hall of Fame. In addition to his three major championships and 18 PGA Tour victories in all, our guest today is also one of the great gentlemen of the game. He was inducted into the World Golf Hall of Fame in 2003, and he's with us today, Nick Price. Welcome to Musings on Golf.
Hey, thanks, Kelly and Bob. Good to chat to you guys again. Good to hear from you.
Yes, sir.
A pleasure to be on with you, Nick, and a couple of things I want to share. Number one, all the time that I was out there and had the privilege of covering your events, people would ask me, who's the nicest guy in professional golf? And I say, well, I got to be honest with you, it's Nick Price. And so if they had a nice guy Hall of Fame, you know, you certainly would be in there. And then another story that pops into my head when I think of Nick Price, and I don't know if you even remember it. You may remember it, but you had that famous caddy, Squeaky Medlin, who had the distinction of caddying for two PGA champions in successive years. Yeah. One caddy for two players, and that's because you couldn't make it at Crooked Stick, and offered the services of Squeaky Medlin to John Daly, and he went on to victory. And Squeaky was a good friend of mine and a good friend of yours, and we We lost them way too soon, Nick. But I take you back to the 71st hole at the Players' Championship. You're agonizing over what club. And Squeaky says, well, Nick, it's either a hard 9-iron or an easy 8-iron. You said, God damn it, Squeak, I'm too nervous to hit an easy 8. Give me that 9-iron.
Yeah, yeah. I remember distinctly telling him, do not give me an in-between yardage here. Yeah. So, anyway, you know, I always worked on the zeros with my club, so the last thing I wanted was a 35 or a 45 or a 55 yardage, 155 yardage.
We lost anyway. Squeaky way too young, Nick. He was a great guy.
We did, and I lost a great friend and also – you know, a lot of memories because, you know, as you get a little older, you forget a lot of the stories and the sort of experiences that you go through. But when you get together with friends, you remember all those things. One of you remembers and it spurs on another memory and so on. So, yes, he left a big hole in my life and I miss him. I miss him a lot.
All right, let's start out, Nick. Tell us what you're doing now.
Well, I do all the things that I really love. We sort of missed out. I didn't do enough of when I was playing, and it's fishing. I do a lot of fishing, fly fishing. I love river fishing, fresh water. I love fishing the flats for bonefish and permit and, you know, tarpon and whatever is around. And then I do a lot of wing shooting in the wintertime, and I travel from all over the place, from England to Argentina to I've been to some really lovely places, and it's one thing. It's about the shooting, but it's more about going with the buddies on these trips. It's like doing, you know, golf trips with your buddies, and have a group of guys. Stadler's one of them who loves to go, and you know, it's a Pat McGowan, as some of you will remember.
Sure.
You know, we go on these trips. We have a lot of fun, and then in between all that, I play golf. You know. I don't know. In the winter time, probably about two or three times a week, and then in summer, hardly, you know, maybe twice, three times a month. But and then we've fortunately the golf course design business has picked up again. We were a little slow there for, you know, we finished our last one I think in 16 or 15 down in Mexico, and we just did a couple of redos here and there, small little redos, and we just got another golf course over near Sarasota, which we actually just broke ground on this past week.
Nick, let me ask you, how did you get started in the golf course design business?
Well, it's just one of those natural sort of progressions, I think, for most players, is that, you know, if you know, when you're playing well, and we all love to think we're great designers and architects. But as you get into it, in your first couple, you sort of start realizing that there's a lot more to it than just, you know, putting a tee in a green somewhere. You know, I started off back in the sort of mid-90s consulting on some courses with some architects, a few architects who taught me an awful lot at the beginning. And then sort of toward the end of the 90s, when my career was really sort of coming, I don't want to say coming to an end, but where I was trying to get some experience in building golf courses and consulting. That's when I really got into it. It's sort of a progression, and I love doing it. I think one of the things that I've always enjoyed about golf courses and having played all over the world is golf's not a one-dimensional game. I think over here we sort of look with these beautiful manicured fairways and beautiful greens and everything, and the ball – America is very much a golf. The game is in the air, and the ground doesn't come into effect that much. And when I say that, if you look at the links courses and, you know, the bounce that you get running the ball onto the green here, a lot of times you've got to carry the ball, you know, a long way in the off the tee. You don't get much run unless it's wintertime or if it's been very dry, because people love to water their golf courses over here because they love to see green. And then, you know, running into the approaches of the greens, here it's all about carrying the ball onto the green, whereas I think the purest form of golf has always been, you know, links course, whether it's Scotland or Ireland or anywhere else in the world where, you know, you can take a 7-iron from, if I normally hit my 7-iron, say 165, from 185 yards and run the ball in 20 yards. And that, I always think, is brings in another skill factor into the game.
Who has been, if you had to pick somebody, is there one architect that influenced you the most, or?
Well, I think Colt and Allison, especially Harry Colt, you know, those two guys built some phenomenal golf courses. And I think more than anything else, you know, the subtlety that they built in their golf courses was just absolutely brilliant. And, you know, Donald Ross was a great architect as well. Alistair McKenzie was great. There've just been so many that I've admired over the years. But I always look back to those old English and Scottish, you know, architects from, you know, the early 1900s who built so many wonderful golf courses around the world.
You know, Nick, I often say that I would stake my introduction to golf as the most humble that it could possibly be. I played a 9-hole golf course that had sand greens, and I played cross-handed. you can't be more humble than that.
No, that's funny. You know, we had a lot of growing up where, in, you know, back home in what was then Rhodesia, you know, a lot of our country district courses had sand greens, you know, which was, it was really, it's hard to explain to people what they were like, what it was like putting on them, but you know, certainly an experience.
Hey, Nick Price joining us here on Musings on Golf. Nick, is the story true about you kind of, and I guess your brothers being involved in golf at the start with plastic golf balls and tomato cans? What was that all about?
Oh, no, that was around our garden, man. Oh, you know, my mom, I lost my dad, you know, when I was about 10 years old. So my mom basically brought me up. So my friends and I started building this little 9-hole, 8-hole golf course around the house, you know, and we had those wiffle balls and we'd hit it over the corner of the house. And, you know, we were just, I mean, the grass wasn't very good, but, you know, we sort of like putted with our wedges and that, but had a great time. And we would go around there for hours and hours on end. And I remember the one occasion, and it was so funny, not at the time, but we have very much similar clay to Georgia, that red clay on where I grew up. And so the one afternoon it had rained, and so we just loved taking divots, and we peppered the side of the house with these red clay divots, which stained. And my mom, about a week later, was walking around the garden and looked up at, in horror at these 150 divot marks on the wall. So we were made to wash it down, and we had to paint it. So needless to say, we made sure that our divots didn't hit the wall after that.
You had a good mom, Nick.
Yeah, you did. Hey, Nick, did the game come quickly, naturally to you in terms of improving and reaching certain levels of skill?
Well, all my two-handed sports that I played, whether it's cricket or baseball, I batted left-handed. So when I started playing golf, my brother had gone to a second-hand shop with two of his mates and bought this real hodgepodge of clubs, 1965 it was. And, you know, I mean, that wasn't long after the Second World War. So a lot of these clubs had come from England, you know, people who had emigrated after the war. So there was a real hodgepodge there. There was hickory shafted clubs. There were a couple of left-handed ones. There were plastic coated steel shafts. there must have been 40 clubs in this bag. And of course they asked me to go along and to the golf course, and being 8 years younger than them, I always wanted to do, you know, the things they were doing. And they said, come, you're caddying. Here was this old canvas bag with a rope for a strap. And there was about 40 clubs in this bag, and this rope was cutting into my shoulder. So anyway, I started hitting. That's how I found a golf ball and started playing with the one left-handed club. But yeah, I think, you know, for me, we'd played so many different sports at school: tennis, squash, we were rugby, we played field hockey, we did athletics, we swam, cross country, we did everything. We were, you know, it was just such a wonderful climate. So when I gravitated toward golf, it was really something special, because I felt like I could go and practice without having, you know, six or seven of my mates around, or having someone to play against in tennis or whatever. And then I switched from left-handed over to right-handed. And funny you mentioned, you know, left hand below right. But I started off playing with my left hand below the right, and then progressed from there. So, but the bug caught me. And to answer your question in a long roundabout way, I'm sorry,
no,
but it was my first sort of two, 3 years, I got down to pretty quickly down to sort of like a 12, 14 handicap, which, you know, when you're 11, 12 years old was pretty good. And then I kind of stagnated because, you know, I was growing and, you know, there were all sorts of issues I was dealing with. You know, I had spasms in my back and my neck from my bones growing a little faster than my muscles were. So, but, you know, once I got to about 14, things started, you know, really changing, and I took to the game very, you know, I just loved playing the game, to be honest. I could go and hit balls for hours, and, you know, if there was two or three of my mates, we'd go and play 54 holes in a day, just keep going around the golf course. So it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, and a lot of fun. And then you made the decision, came over and played in the Optimist Junior World in San Diego. I think that was in 74, and first time in the States, and you won it. What do you remember from that? What was that like coming to the States, and what was it like winning?
Well, first of all, it was really lucky for me to get over here because, you know, the Optimist people at the Junior World gave each country, you know, $500 toward their expenses, and I could never have afforded to come over here. So, you know, I ended up coming over here just thankfully to them. So I owe them a lot for giving me the opportunity. But, you know, it was an absolute dream come true. I mean, I still look back on that week and think, you know, how much did that change the course of my life? Well, immensely, because I think my mom then realized, instead of me pursuing this pipe dream of becoming some kind of, you know, professional golfer, you know, there was an opportunity there that and if I continue to mature, and also that there was a chance to come to university over here on a scholarship, which is, you know, I mean, the university is expensive anywhere you go, but it was a great opportunity. It was such a wonderful week for me. And I stayed with Doug Clark, who was an outstanding junior golfer back in the 70s from Southern California. And he and his parents, we just had an absolute blast, and they were so happy that I won. You know, I went back home, and I mean, obviously I was on cloud nine for months after that.
Deservedly so, for sure. You know, you have certainly have had a different swing. And do you give David Ledbetter any credit for helping you advance in your game?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, David, you know, it's funny. David was the first guy I really ever took a serious lesson from. I had lessons from other guys along the way, but it was more like they were giving me tips as opposed to, you know, an in-depth sort of critical or examination of your swing, you know, and that's the first time I did that was in 1982 with David. And, you know, it's funny, we learned to play the game by reading books, watching television, and we didn't have videos in those days. You know, we had those Super 8 millimeter film cameras, which were, you know, you couldn't slow-mo, you couldn't do anything with those without the film melting. And so we learned from just mimicking. And, you know, but a lot of us, when you read, if you give 100 kids the same book to read, you know, you'll get 100 different interpretations. And a great teacher will always help to explain to the people what the author of the book is trying to do. And so when you learn about the golf swing through books, you know, you might be on a parallel path to what is correct, but you may also be quite a way off. And when I first went to David, you know, I spent the first week with him just looking at all of the fundamentals, and everything was quite close, but in other ways, it was a long way off. My misinterpretation of some of the swing plane and some of the other things really was off. And so we worked on that. We worked a lot on the swing plane. We worked in on all the basic and the fundamentals. And, you know, the one thing he never told me to do was slow my swing down, because, you know, I could never have done that. I mean, my natural rhythm was upbeat, but what we did work on was being smoother away from the ball, and instead of being a little snatchy, you know, going back with the club head. So, but he was an immense help to me, and sort of once the penny dropped for me, then, you know, it opened up a whole new horizon, because I didn't really realize, you know, how good I could be. But of course, then within that first three months of me seeing him, I nearly won the British Open in Troon in 1982. So I knew I was on the right track.
Hey, Nick, by the way, how did that begin with David? Did he reach out to you? Did you reach out to him? What was the process?
So, no, we played junior golf. David grew up, you know, what was then Rhodesia as well. And we played junior golf together, although he's a little older than I am. But I think it was in about 1968. I think I was 11 and David was like 16. And, you know, he always had his nose buried in golf magazines. And obviously he really wanted to play. But after about, I think he turned pro relatively young age of about 18 or 19. And then, you know, he didn't quite make it as a player. He was always one of those guys who would shoot, you know, 71, 68, 78, could never sort of put three rounds together or four rounds together. And so he turned to teaching. And then I was in England playing on the European tour and ran into him. And he said, you know, I'm teaching now. So and then, you know, one thing led to another. And Dennis Watson had worked with him in 1981 over here. And I had a terrible year in 1981 in Europe. And I phoned David up at the end of 1981. I said, listen, I got to come see you because I'm lost. And I was genuinely lost. I'd probably hit more balls and practiced more hours in 1981 than I had in the previous 2 years. And my game was getting worse. So I knew something was wrong. So, you know, it was really great for me to come over here in the spring of 82 and work with him. And, you know, we've been great friends for a long time. In fact, you know, he's more like a brother to me than a coach. You know, we've really had a lot of fun together over the years.
Yeah, I'm good friends with David. He's certainly dedicated to the sport. There's one story, you know, you can't make the 1991 PGA Championship at Crooked Stick. And John Daly gets in at the last minute. How did your caddy end up with John Daly?
Well, I withdrew on a Tuesday afternoon because there was no, my Sue was just late. And the doctor said to me, no, this is not going to happen for a while. So I withdrew on the Tuesday afternoon. And then John phoned me on the Wednesday morning driving up. And he was in the car. It was one of those, you know, they just got one of those car phones. And I said, what are you doing? Are you driving? He said, yeah. Because I got, yeah. And he said, oh, I've got one of these new car phones. I said, oh, that's great. Anyway, and he said, you're not going. You're not coming. I said, no, I'm not. I said, but listen, please, you know, Squeak's from Indiana. He was from Gary. I said, you know, you've got to take him. He's been up there the whole week just, you know, charting the course and whatever. And he said, yeah, that's great. That's what I was going to call you about to find out who was caddying for you. So, and they hooked up, and the rest was history. You know, I mean, it was amazing how well John played, and I know Squeak helped him immensely because Squeak was such a great grounder, I suppose, was the best thing. Yeah. You know, and wouldn't let you get too far ahead of yourself. So then, you know, he phoned me on the Sunday night after they'd won, and I just said to him, "Please don't leave me. Don't." We'd had a really good 91. You know, I'd won the Byron Nelson in May and had a couple of really good shows. And I said, no, you can't leave me. He said, I'm not going anywhere. I'm staying with you, Nick. So.
There you go. I got a call from Squeaky, actually, the day before he passed away. And we had quite an emotional conversation over the phone. He was crying. I was crying. He knew that the end was near. But what a, you know, great caddy, yes, but wonderful human being.
And, absolutely.
And Nick, he loved caddying. I mean, he loved it. I mean, yeah. And that's why, you know, in part, he was so great at it.
An unbelievable human being. Really, really, like I say, Bob, I miss him a lot, you know, because, and I think, you know, and no discredit to any of my other caddies who worked for me after that, but, you know, if he had been around, I think I probably would have won, you know, a few more, well, a lot more tournaments in the 90s. But that, you know, him passing in 97, well, it was devastating for me.
We are on the back nine with the great Nick Price here on Musings on Golf. Nick, a couple questions from me, and then I'll turn it back over to Bob to bid you farewell. But 92, I was working for PGA Magazine in 1992 when you went to Bellerive outside of St. Louis and won your first major championship, won by three strokes over four guys, including Nick Faldo. I'm wondering, what was it like for you? You had won PGA Tour events, but what was it like to finally break through in a major championship with the pressures that came with that, as opposed to winning a PGA Tour event?
Well, you know, the major is the ultimate compliment that you can pay yourself as a professional golfer. There's nothing else that quite quenches that thirst and desire like winning a major. And for me, you know, having had close shaves in 82 at the Open Championship at Troon, 1985, the PGA at Cherry Hills, then 86 at Augusta, 87, I played really well in the PGA that Jeff Sluman won, except for the last round. And then, you know, 88, Seve and I went head to head. And then, you know, I had like, you know, six or seven really decent opportunities to win a major before that came along in 92, the PGA. And I was ready. You know, I was 35 years old and I felt like I was in the prime of my career. And I remember going on the back nine that day. In fact, before the back nine, I started, I said to, you know, Squeak, no mistakes today. We're just going to play good, solid, mistake-free golf and not take any unnecessary chances unless we really have to. And I think the back nine, I played about as well and as disciplined as I could. And, you know, that's always the difference. You know, I remember Jack Nicklaus always saying, you know, he kept his head while all those around him were losing theirs. And under the pressure of a major championship, there is no truer saying than that. You have to just keep your head and you just do what you know what you can do best. And obviously the other guys, the way they're playing, are going to influence your decision making. But, you know, it's one of those things you have to be disciplined. And so to break through was just wonderful for me.
Well, and then 2 years later was the biggest year, clearly, of your career. You held off Jesper Parnevik to win by a shot at the Open Championship at Turnberry. You turn around, you win the PGA Championship at Southern Hills, really ran away with it. And then, a month or so later, you win the Canadian Open. Boy, if you were ready in 92 to win your first, it was a massive explosion in the best possible way. What was the difference? What happened in 94 in that very compact couple of months that allowed you to burst through with three massive victories?
Yeah, well, you know, first of all, you know, the next major or big championship I played in 93 was the Players' Championship, and I won that, you know, by four or five shots. So, you know, I don't know, when you win a major or when you break through and you win, there's always an X factor, a confidence factor, as to how much confidence are you lacking or how much confidence is that win going to give you. Well, I don't know what my factor was, but it was more than 10. It just gave me, you know, they always say, take even the monkey off your back. It just gave me so much belief, self-belief, which I think I was missing. And I just went from strength to strength, you know, and I got to the stage where, when my putting was really solid, that it wasn't a question of, you know, if I was going to win, it was when I'm going to win next. And, you know, that confidence just kept going and going and getting stronger and stronger. And, you know, 93 and 94, the 2 years, you know, I won the money list and got player of the year. You just, it's, I caught lightning in a bottle. But, you know, it wasn't something that was a fluke, because I'd been a journeyman for most of my career. And, you know, I was now playing at a level that I really had wanted to play at my entire life. And I didn't want to let it go, you know, and that was really the great thing was, you know, that period lasted, you know, 5 or 6 years in my career, which, and going at that pace, it's very tough to do that. I had a great time and I was very grateful that I got to that stage, because it was a level that I never really knew I was going to, you know, get to number one in the world and, you know, and when I played well, dominate like I did.
Nick, you know, when I introduced you as a real gentleman of the game and Bob talked about you being a great guy, how did you balance being a, quote, really good, nice guy with also being a ferocious competitor in the golf course?
Well, that was one of the hardest things, you know, I mean, to say no to everybody out on the PGA Tour, you know, who's involved with the tour, the media and whatever, they have a job to do. So you try and accommodate those guys as much as you can. But, you know, back in the sort of 80s and early 90s, it was easy because I only had a few requests. But then all of a sudden, when all hell broke loose, you know, I've now got you know, literally 20, 30 requests every day to go and do stuff. And yeah. I wish I'd had the ability to say no a little more often. You know, going back to 1995, I had to do 6 media days, you know, and that just, that was a Monday. It doesn't sound like much, but when you're going flat out and you've got to fly from, you know, New York to California to do a media day or whatever it is, I mean, it's hard work. And that wore me out really in 95. And I think in hindsight, if I went back to that, I would probably have said a little no a little more often. But, you know, it was fine. I mean, you know, 96 came along, and I started playing a little better. 95 was a little disappointing. And then, you know, 97 through about 2003, my game was still strong, but it wasn't at the level that it was in 92, 3, and 4.
Nick, as we close this interview, I've always admired you for being such a class act. And I mean that from the bottom of my heart. I have to believe that being named recipient of the Payne Stewart Award in 2002 meant so much to you because of what the award stands for.
Well, you know, Payne and I, we were born a day apart.
Wow.
Yeah, he's, I think, the 29th, I'm the 28th. Or he's the 27th, I'm 28th, I'm not sure. But anyway, it's, if you look at our careers, they were very, very similarly or evenly matched. You know, we both ended up winning 3 majors. He won 2 US Opens and a PGA. And I don't know what his total was. I think he won 16 on the PGA Tour. It was either 15 or 16. It may have been more. But we were very, very similar career-wise. And plus, when we lived in Orlando, you know, I wasn't a great friend of Payne's, but I was a good friend of his. And I felt like, you know, when we would play golf, we had a lot of things in common and that. But, you know, I just admired Payne a lot. He was a guy who loved the microphone. He loved the limelight and he loved to be out in front of people. I was a little more reserved. But what a tragedy that happened to him. I think about where I was that day, and like a lot of other people. But anyway, when they started with a Payne Stewart Award, and then Commissioner Fincham phoned me in 2003 and told me, 2002, sorry, and said, "Nick, you're going to be the next recipient." I was absolutely over the moon, because you know Payne stood for a lot of great things in golf. His sportsmanship, you know, the way he dressed, the way he entertained. Really is a legend of the game.
Hey, Nick, let me share a story with you about Payne. He finishes second in the U.S. Open out in San Francisco. And I'm doing the runner-up interview with him for the United States Golf Association. And the last thing he says to me, "Bob, I will win the U.S. Open at Pinehurst." And lo and behold, he wins that U.S. Open at Pinehurst.
Yep.
What a guy. I miss him. I know you miss him.
Amazing, yeah.
You guys were cut of the same cloth, classy, talented, and real down to earth. And, Nick, can't thank you enough for joining us on Musings on Golf. You've been a very special guest.
Oh, thank you so much, Bob. And it's good to chat again. It's been a long time.
When you make the best performing golf balls in the world, your biggest competition is yourself. And now the golf ball that sets the standard for every other has raised the bar again. New Titleist Pro V1 and Pro V1X are longer and more consistent with unrivaled control. Outperform with new Pro V1 and Pro V1X. Titleist, the number one ball in golf.
Bob, that was a lot of fun with Nick, and it's so great to hear that he's enjoying things in life, the fly fishing, and keeping his hand in the design work and playing the game. All good things come to people like Nick Price. He's always been one of my favorites, and I know he's been one of your favorites, too.
Absolutely. I would officially title him a gentleman's gentleman. Great for the game, a tremendous player, and like I said, just a wonderful ambassador for for this wonderful sport of golf.
I agree, and we thank Nick Price, member of the World Golf Hall of Fame, for joining us. Kelly Elbin signing off for my good friend Bob Bupka on Musings on Golf.